We're going to go directly to the next 45-minute side of the program. We're going all the way up till 10 o'clock tonight. So it's 12 straight hours of documentation. So those of you who are taping, and hopefully you will be taping or are taping, be ready to go all the way till 10 o'clock this evening. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. We're going to go directly to the next side of the tape. Those of you who are taping, this side is 45 minutes in length. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
His presence had a powerful effect on the business community of Germany. IG, after all, was the country's largest corporation. Schacht announced that he expected to raise 3 million marks from the assembled businessmen for Hitler's election campaign. At the direction of Bosch, Schnitzler pledged 400,000 marks, by far the largest single donation. IG's support of Hitler was now official. So the initial enmity between IG and Hitler smoothed over by common ground, and they eventually became deeply married. And once again, this despite the fact that IG Farben did have a great many Jews in positions of power. And as I've noted, the Germans themselves were quite willing to come to terms with those Jews who, the Nazis, I should say, were quite willing to come to terms with those Jews who were sufficiently wealthy and willing to work alongside of them. One of these people that were initially attacked by the Nazis, Kurt Oppenheim, eventually became an honorary Aryan. And note again the presence of Max Warburg in the IG. And Warburg, of course, a German member of the House of Warburg, one of these transatlantic financial firms, which is central to the entire topic of discussion in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Continuing now with this addendum, what we're going to look at next is the creation of the American subsidiary of IG Farben, that was later, on the eve of World War II, renamed General Annalen and Film, and it goes by that name to this day. You can see it as GAF, the firm is known as today. Take note also here of one of the members of the board of directors of American IG, in addition to Edsel Ford, who we heard about earlier, and Walter Teagle, president of Standard Oil. We're going to take a look here at Paul M. Warburg of the Warburg banking family, again S.G. Warburg, the London branch of this transatlantic financial family, deeply involved in the resurrection of IG Farben in 1990. But right here, we're in 1929, and we're going to take a look at the creation of the American IG.
I'm going to switch cassette decks real fast here because we're only coming through one channel, it looks like, on this particular cassette deck. So hence the slight interruption here. We're going to go directly back to the tape.
On April 26, 1929, an advertisement appeared in the financial sections of the leading American newspapers announcing a $30 million issue of American IG Chemical Company 5.5% convertible debentures. IG Farben's backing was set forth in bold type. Principal and interest and premium, if any, upon redemption unconditionally guaranteed by endorsement on each debenture by IG Farben Industry Aktien Gesellschaft, IG Dies, Frankfurt on the Main, Germany. To, unquote, to inspire investor confidence, the board of directors of American IG included four impressive figures from American industry and finance. Walter Teagle, T-E-A-G-L-E, president of Standard Oil of New Jersey, Edsel Ford, president of the Ford Motor Company, Charles E. Mitchell, chairman of the National City Bank, and Paul M. Warburg, a member of the financially powerful Warburg banking family. I.G. Farben was represented by Carl Bosch and Hermann Schmitz, who were listed respectively as chairman and president of the new company. So it's interesting that we find Paul Warburg, an American member of this of the Warburg family, involved in the initial floating of securities for American I.G. Farben. We took a look at Max Warburg as a member of the board of directors of German IG, and S.G. Warburg, the London branch of the family involved in reviving the IG in the summer of 1990. So as we behold the span of this particular concatenation, it's interesting to note that the same forces are indeed at work today. And as I noted in the discussion earlier, when we see here in 1992, when we see George Bush, whose family has long been involved with many of these same interests, when we see him talking about the New World Order, that was Hitler's phrase. Recall that a key General Motors official who was openly sympathetic to Hitler and had initially been appointed to help oversee the reconstruction of the German economy after World War II, that fellow was Graham K. Howard, who wrote a book called, in 1940, called America and the New World Order, which was an apologia for Adolf Hitler. So, again, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And I think it's worth taking note here in 1992 of how many of these same interests have been active politically from the 1920s right on up to the present, and they continue to have a profound effect on our world today, and frankly a very detrimental effect. This concludes this particular addendum to Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Again, the original of May 23rd, 1980, addendum 8-12-1990. This addendum is 5-24-1990. Again, the world that we now see emerging before us is a world which would be greatly to the liking of Adolf Hitler as well as Mussolini, and one of the reasons why the world has moved in the direction it has moved is that the conventional history of fascism, which basically says that once upon a time there were two bad men named Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, and they hypnotized all the Germans and all the Italians, and Emperor Hirohito hypnotized all the Japanese, they all went crazy, they had a big nasty war, but along came the Allies and defeated them in battle, and the world would have lived happily ever after, but along came another bad man named Joseph Stalin, hypnotized all the Russians, and now we had the Cold War, which has now come to an end. In fact, as I've looked at in numerous archive shows, the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America number 10, the aforementioned Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, the aforementioned Uncle Sam and Il Duce broadcast, as well as the broadcast about Japanese fascism and its connections with U.S. industry and finance, the fascist powers of World War II could in effect be thought of as Western industry's hitmen against socialism and the Soviet Union in particular. There were very strong Marxist movements in Europe and elsewhere, and in order to counter this threat or perceived threat, the world's industrialists and financiers banded together, imperfectly at first, but they've honed their act, so to speak, in recent decades. They banded together and actively supported. It's not to say that this was a monolith, but the world's industrialists and financiers were, to a large extent, in agreement about their support for fascism. The competition between the U.S. and Japan for empire in the Western Pacific ultimately led to the breakdown of this cooperation between American and Western industry and finance and the fascist powers of World War II. But that cooperation has been made far more efficient in the decades following the Second World War. Adolf Hitler referred to his plan for the world as the, quote, New World Order, and the New Order in Europe. In the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, we took a look at a book published in 1940 by a General Motors official named Robert K. Graham, who was an unabashed supporter of Adolf Hitler. General Motors is one of the many U.S. industrial firms deeply involved with the Third Reich. And Robert K. Graham called his book America and a New World Order. It was an apologia for Hitler. Well, just as Robert K. Graham was involved with, he advocated America and a New World Order, now we find Mrs. Bush's baby boy, George, talking about the New World Order.
Correction, that's actually Graham K. Howard. Got the name wrong on that one, so do note that for future purpose.
And it's worth noting that the Bush family themselves have roots in this transatlantic industrial and financial axis, which was instrumental not only in supporting fascism politically, but instrumental in providing vital materiel to the fascist war machines of World War II. This information came to light, and once in a while, that transatlantic industrial and financial axis that I've been discussing for so many years does hit the press. And there was a very fine article by Curtis Lang, L-A-N-G, in the Village Voice. By the way, research credit on this goes to a listener who Xeroxed this off for me. It's called Will Family Scandals Sink George Bush? Well, actually, offhand, I cannot find the date because I think the Xerox has cut this off, but it's got to be on one of these pages here. In any event, this was from the Village Voice. If I can't give you the exact date, I will get it for you next week. It was a cover story of a recent issue of the Village Voice, and people should not have too much difficulty finding it. In any event, this particular Curtis Lang article touches on, among other things, the role of George Bush's father, Prescott Bush Sr., in this particular transatlantic industrial and financial axis. the article, skipping well down into the article, after discussing how George Bush viewed his father as the dominant influence in his life, Curtis Lang goes on to write, Prescott Bush could sing and dance and knew the secrets of survival among the predators on Wall Street, where he worked as senior managing partner of the private banking firm Brown Brothers Harriman & Company from 1931 until 1949. Quote, this was a company General Smedley Butler claimed was behind the 1909 U.S. invasion of Nicaragua. In 1938, they arranged for a loan of tetraethyl lead to the Nazi Luftwaffe, recounts muckraking trading card impresario Paul Brancato, creator of the Bush League set of cards. Quote, they helped finance Time Incorporated and Newsweek. At various times, Prescott Bush served as a board member of CBS, Prudential Insurance Company of America, Dresser Industries, Pan American Airways Corporation, Union Banking Corporation, and the United States Guarantee Corporation. Skipping down, although not a major player in international financial circles during World War II, Prescott Bush found himself present at the birth of the 20th century's industrialized global war economy, an historical crossroads where patriotic considerations coincided with calculations of profit and loss. From 1934 to 1942, Prescott Bush served as a board member of the Union Banking Corporation, an affiliate of Brown Brothers Harriman. The Union Banking Corporation had originally operated out of the offices of W.A. Harriman & Company. The president of Harriman was George Herbert Herbie Walker, Prescott Bush's father-in-law and George Bush's grandfather and namesake. Remember George Herbert or Herbie Walker. We're going to come back to him later. In 1931, Harriman merged with the British American investment house of Brown Brothers, and Brown Brothers Harriman was born. The U.S. government seized Union Banking as a front for the Nazis in October 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act, according to a recent article in the Austin Chronicle by David Armstrong. The government found that the bank was controlled by the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart NV of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, and that this Dutch bank was in turn controlled by German industrialist Fritz Thyssen and his associates. Spellings, by the way, that bank is Handel en Scheepvaart, it's H-A-N-D-E-L, small E-N, capital S-C-H-E-E-P-V-A-A-R-T, and Fritz Thyssen is spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. By the way, Thyssen figured in a prominent way in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, one of the driving forces behind the Vereinigte Stahlwerke, a cartel, set up in considerable measure with the assistance of American capital. Continuing, Thyssen was instrumental in financing Adolf Hitler's rise to power. Then, fearing he had, quote, ruined Germany, fled to Switzerland, was captured by the Vichy police, and returned to Germany where the Nazis kept him captive for the duration. Thus, the Bush and Walker families were intimately involved in operations at Union Banking throughout the time that the Baron Thyssen was funneling his money between America and Europe and channeling over $1 million to Hitler during the crucial years of his rise to power. Quote, Brown Brothers owned two German intermediaries like the Schroeder Bank, which the Nazis also used, explains Burton Hirsch, author of the explosive new book, The Old Boys, The American Elite, and the Origins of the CIA. Interrupting briefly, the Schroeder Bank was something we looked at considerable length in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May 23rd of 1980. I would also strongly recommend the book mentioned here, The Old Boys, The American Elite, and the Origins of the CIA. It goes into the American role in floating bond issues for the German cartels. It's an excellent book. I haven't finished reading it, but it is one of the best books ever written on U.S. intelligence. So a hearty endorsement from yours truly for this particular book. Proceeding with the article, Hirsch explains that big German industrial compounds like IG Farben, the notorious arms dealer, chemical manufacturer, and beneficiary of concentration camp labor, scoured the world for investment capital during the 1920s and 1930s in an attempt to rebuild their tattered fiefdoms. Quote, Farben tried to put together a chemical cartel. They put together a steel cartel and a potash cartel, Hirsch recounts. In order to do that, they did substantially what Michael Milken did. They tried to find somewhere to get enough money to recapitalize. Since we had most of the money in the world at the time, they came to New York, and the big brokerage firms and banks like Dillon Reed, Brown Brothers Harriman, and Citicorp went out and sold bonds in tremendous numbers to American bondholders in German firms, which then used that money to create the big cartels. Recall, we discussed that at considerable length in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Continuing with the account, these brokerage firms were getting a big slice of whatever they raised. They were delighted to do it. There was no risk, unquote. Union Banking was not the only Nazi-friendly company affiliated with the Harriman Walker Bush Group. At the end of World War I, Herbie Walker had brokered a deal granting investment bankers at W.A. Harriman control of the North American operations of a German-American shipping company called the Hamburg America Line. A congressional investigation found that the Hamburg America Line had subsidized a wide range of pro-Nazi propaganda efforts both in Germany and in the United States. Averell Harriman, Herbie Walker, and Prescott Bush were the directors of the Harriman 15 Corporation, a holding company that controlled the North American subsidiary of the Hamburg America Line. American Shipping and Commerce... A congressional investigation found that the Hamburg America Line had subsidized a wide range of pro-Nazi propaganda efforts both in Germany and the United States. Averell Harriman, Herbie Walker, and Prescott Bush were directors of the Harriman 15 Corporation, a holding company that controlled the North American subsidiary of the Hamburg America Line, American Shipping and Commerce Corporation, during the period prior to 1934. The Harriman 15 Corporation also held stock in the Silesian American Corporation, a holding company with assets in German and Polish steelmaking and zinc and copper mining operations. In 1942, the U.S. government reported that, quote, these steel and mining properties have been in the possession and have been operated by the German government and have undoubtedly been of considerable assistance to that country in its war effort, unquote. Government agents seized both the Hamburg America Line and the Silesian American Corporation under the Trading with the Enemy Act in 1942. The seizure perhaps presaged the Iran-Contra and Iraq-Gate scandals, in which George Bush appeared to be involved in both trading with the enemy and holding up aggressive militaristic dictatorships. How did Bush, Walker, and Harriman come to have such close ties with Nazi Germany? According to historians, they were merely typical representatives of America's business elite, as James Stewart Martin noted in All Honorable Men from 1950, not criminals, but businessmen, not Nazis, but honorable, actually no, not Nazis, but businessmen, not criminals, but honorable men. The last two sentences from the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, also the last two sentences from James Stewart Martin's book, All Honorable Men. James Stewart Martin having been arguably the most important investigator of this business elite and their connections to the Third Reich. Continuing. During the period between the two world wars, it was natural that Wall Street financiers and high-powered international attorneys like Wild Bill Donovan and the Dulles brothers, schooled in the realpolitik of the global marketplace, would act as amateur spooks and ambassadors without portfolio. Balance of power politics, which rested on a rigorous pragmatism, influenced the worldview of these American shapers of today's global economy. In realpolitik, the geopolitical needs of the moment condition the president's position on human rights around the world, freeing him to make alliances with military dictators and other unsavory but perhaps useful characters. Interrupting again, a calm judgment of business necessity. In the global marketplace, the need to maximize profits conditions business people to forge alliances with countries considered, quote, unfriendly, unquote, to their own. Thus, the same qualities that impelled the Wall Streeters to cut deals with Nazis made them perfect candidates for positions of power in the OSS during World War II and later in the CIA, which was primarily built up around the personnel recruited from Wall Street firms. Skipping down in this particular story, William Stamps Farish, grandfather of President George Bush's longtime hunting buddy, William Stamps Farish III, heir to the Standard Oil fortune, was also targeted by Congress for the extensive deals Standard Oil made with Nazi firms, including I.G. Farben, supplying the Nazis with extensive contracts for rubber products needed to keep the Nazi war machine rolling along. Farish received a wrist slap fine of $1,000 after a Justice Department investigation, but all the negative publicity surrounding him contributed to a fatal heart attack. By contrast, Prescott Bush managed to avoid most of the unpleasant fallout from his business partner's international wheeling and dealing, and the scandal proved to be no real problem in Prescott Bush's successful 1952 campaign to become U.S. Senator from Connecticut. I would note, too, that the Standard Oil IG agreements were also featured prominently in the discussion in Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Skipping down, now remember Herbie Walker, okay? That is George Bush's grandfather, one of the people involved with the formation of Brown Brothers Harriman. We're coming back to him later. Herbie Walker, the investment banker who had so many strange dealings with Nazi financiers and German industrialists during the run-up to World War II, provided $300,000 to start the new company. That's George Bush's oil company called Bush Overby Oil Development. Overby is O-V-E-R-B-E-Y. One more time here. That's a comma, not a period. Again, the copying here is a little bit tough to read in places. Herbie Walker, the investment banker who had so many strange dealings with Nazi financiers and a German industrialist during the run-up to World War II, provided $300,000 to start the new company called Bush Overby Oil Development, which concentrated on buying up oil leases. In 1953, Bush had a reputation as a man with a pipeline to big money, and two members of the Texas oil raj, Hugh and Bill Liedtke, L-I-E-D-T-K-E, who owned an oil business in Tulsa but had been schooled in Massachusetts, offered to join forces with Bush Overby. Once again, Herbie helped out with young George's share of the equity capital, and Zapata Petroleum was born. So we find people deeply involved, again, Bush ancestors like Herbert Walker Bush, deeply involved with helping to get young George his start in the oil business. And remember that Prescott Bush Sr. Was a member of this transatlantic industrial and financial axis, which was so deeply involved with supporting the Third Reich politically and militarily. And again, those archive shows are vital for an understanding of this particular connection. I will have the exact date on this particular article for you next week. Again, it's a cover story in the Village Voice within the last 6 weeks or so. Should not be that difficult for people to locate. And right on the cover, so simply get a hold, find a library which carries the Village Voice, and it's right on the cover within the last 6 weeks or so. We now speak from the vantage point of June 14th, 1992. And it's worth noting, too, that George Bush's, the Bush family's Nazi associations have continued apace. In a miscellaneous archive show called Nazis and Anti-Semites on the Bush campaign, I took note of the presence of fascist, Nazi, and fascist collaborators on the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council, originally put together by Richard Nixon in 1970. This did emerge during the 1988 presidential campaign, but tragically did not get the notice it deserved. So Bush's Nazi sympathies, or the Bush family's Nazi associations, continue right up until this time. It should be noted that as director of the CIA, George Bush was deeply involved with collaborating with Third Reich and residual fascist elements in such organizations as the World Anti-Communist League and in such programs as the Death Squad activities in Latin America and elsewhere. So, as William Faulkner said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And it is interesting to see in this particular Village Voice article, and again, I'll have the date for you next week, it's interesting to see the genesis of George Bush's financial fortunes coming from people in his family who were part of this very, very significant transatlantic industrial and financial axis. That axis, and I use the term advisedly, at the heart of so many of the deep tragedies that have befallen the human race in the 20th century. And when you hear George Bush talking about the New World Order, remember that's Hitler's phrase. And Robert K. Graham in 1940 advocated America and a New World Order. Well, we've got it now, and unfortunately, it looks like we're going to get it in the future. We're going to take a musical break now, and then we're going to come back with more of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. By the way, a listener phoned in the date of that Village Voice article that I finished reading during the last segment of the prepared portion of the broadcast was from May 5th of 1992. So that very fine cover story by Curtis Lang can be found again, May 5th, 1992 issue of the Village Voice. This evening, we are doing the annual KFJC Memorial Day program, the Memorial Day special Uncle Sam and the Swastika and related material. This covers the profound industrial and financial connections between many of America's most powerful industrialists and financiers, and not only Nazi Germany, but as we'll hear in the not-too-distant future, Mussolini's Italy as well. In fact, the fascist state, the corporate state of Mussolini, was in considerable measure propped up by American capital. What I'm going to do now, though, is I'm going to add a little bit of material to the archives Perhaps this, I haven't decided what we will do with this. Perhaps this will be yet another addendum to Uncle Sam and the swastika, or perhaps it'll stand alone, or maybe both. I don't know. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to read a very important piece of history into the record, and this by way of fleshing out the listening audience's understanding of just what it was that motivated many of the most prominent industrialists and financiers and corporations in the world, American, German, British, and French, to back fascism. Not just those countries, but many others as well. Why did they back fascism? Well, as we have seen and will see, anti-communism was a major motive, but beyond that, there's something even more significant, though not unrelated. The very issue of democracy itself was seized upon very cleverly by Adolf Hitler, and was manipulated by Adolf Hitler in such a way as to discredit democracy as being, in effect, the antechamber to communism. What Hitler maintained in his speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf was that basically the assembled industrialists and financiers were the elite of society. They were the best people in society. It's almost a quasi-Calvinist notion of the elect, and that they enjoyed their superior position in society because they were, in fact, superior. And that if they allowed the hoi polloi, so to speak, if they allowed the masses to control the political process by virtue of a democracy, that this ultimately would lead to a degeneration of society. This would prove to be counter-evolutionary, not counter-revolutionary, but counter-evolutionary with an E. It was maintained by Hitler, and he found a very willing audience, not only with the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, but with many other industrialists and financiers as well. It was maintained that, therefore, democracy itself was undesirable because it would be utilized by the masses to effect economic redistribution. To a certain extent, at least, it is true. Certainly, democracy does permit economic redistribution. In fact, the whole idea of democracy is to empower people politically so that they can better their situation. It's the basic underlying premise. However, many members of the listening audience in the calendar year 1993, and for the benefit of those who hear this on tape, it is now May 30th of 1993, they may be wondering just how it could be that industrialists and financiers could support a totalitarian like Adolf Hitler or Mussolini. It shouldn't really come as that much of a shock. The U.S. And the American-based multinational corporations back up dictators in many parts of the world, particularly the Third World. However, there remains something of an historical blind spot for many people, many observers, including many in the so-called progressive political sector. They do not recognize or will not recognize the connection between American industrialists and financiers and the fascist powers of Europe. They will not recognize that just as many American corporate interests successfully seek to institute fascism in the Third World, they will also be inclined to do the same thing here in the United States, because they view democracy with suspicion. Now, it was Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf that persuaded many of the top industrialists and financiers of Germany to back Hitler and the German Nazi Party, as opposed to some of the other conservative political parties that were in Germany at the time. This speech, the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, is, as I've said, it is not only very significant in terms of the evolution of German Nazism itself and the evolution of Adolf Hitler's political fortunes, it also has a larger significance, and I think it has a terrifyingly relevant perspective for those of us in 1993. It should be remembered that there are many in the corporate world, of course not all, I'm not even saying most, but many in the corporate world who will view the attitudes of Adolf Hitler with great favor, and consequently will view democracy with disdain, fear, and contempt. For our discussion of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, we are going to turn to a book which I used in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast way back on May 23rd, 1980. This book is called Who Financed Hitler? Subtitled The Secret Funding of Hitler's Rise to Power, 1919 and 1933. It's authored by James Poole and Suzanne Poole, P-O-O-L. This book was published in both hardcover and softcover by the Dial Press and copyrighted 1979. Now again, the central feature of the pitch that Adolf Hitler gave before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, and it was a very successful pitch as well. As I said, it won over much of the industrial and financial elite of Germany, much of the corporate elite of Germany, over to the Nazi Party. Hitler's Hitler's pitch was that democracy itself is inherently subversive. As I said, the underlying premise was almost quasi-Calvinist or perhaps social Darwinist. It was Hitler's contention that what he called the politics of personality, the authority of personality, should be dominant rather than the democratic process. Again, he told the assembled industrialists and financiers that they were superior. They enjoyed their superior position in society because they had superior abilities, and that their superior position was a direct manifestation of their inherent superiority. And he maintained that democracy itself, disdained by some as the mob beast, that democracy itself was subversive because it allowed inferior people to wield political power for their own benefit, and that this would lead to a degeneration of society. Beyond that, Hitler went on to make a very explicit connection. He equated democracy with communism, and that is a viewpoint that unfortunately many of the world's industrialists and financiers, many of the world's corporate interests to this day maintain, and unfortunately that has been reflected in much of American foreign policy as it has been manifested since the end of the Second World War. The individual who brought Adolf Hitler to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf was an individual who you heard described earlier in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. That's a fellow named Fritz Thyssen, capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, a German steelmaker. We discussed Thyssen not only in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May of 1980, but also in one of the addenda from June 14th of 1992. And it was Fritz Thyssen who brought Adolf Hitler to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now, the pool's discussion of Hitler's speech here, to a large extent, speaks for itself, but bear in mind that the basic premise was a sort of quasi-Calvinist or social Darwinist view, which maintained that the industrialists and financiers, and bear in mind that in the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, there were 600 of the most prominent of the German industrial and financial elite present, the contention of Hitler's was that they were inherently superior, and that is why they enjoyed their superior position in society, because they had superior abilities, and those superior abilities manifested themselves in their superior position. He then said that democracy was bad because it allowed inferior people to wield power, and that ultimately those inferior people would restructure society for their own benefit, and that this would be counter-evolutionary. It would lead to a degeneration of society. Beyond that, Hitler goes on to equate democracy with communism directly. And again, that's a viewpoint which is shared by a terrifyingly large section of the corporate elite, not only in this country, but of the world as a whole. I'm not maintaining that all of them feel that way, not even necessarily most, although one could argue perhaps that in terms of the ultimate manifestation of multinational corporate capitalism, it has worked out that way, but I will not make that contention. But we should note, as I have tried to point out in the past, that fascism is not something foreign to the United States, that many of the most prominent industrial and financial people, many of the most prominent elements of corporate society were openly pro-fascist and pro-Hitler in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and that they, to a large extent, have maintained that stance since in terms of the way they have governed not only the United States, but also much of the Third World as well. So Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, again, was not only significant because of its place in the historical rise of Hitler, its place in the history of the rise of German fascism, it has a larger historical and political and sociological significance as well, one which bears great significance for those of us here in the United States in May of 1993. The pool's right of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now, bear in mind, this is 1931 when we're talking here. This is this might actually be the very beginning of 1932. I have always said that this was 1931. I may actually be wrong. I guess this was January 27th of 1932. So upon reading, I've always said this was 31. Actually, it was the very first month of 1932, so I will correct that error on the spot. Anyway, of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf in January, specifically January 27th of 1932, the pools write as follows. Now again, Thyssen is Baron Fritz Thyssen, a key German steel magnate. A few days later, Thyssen was in Berlin, where he claimed he met Hitler by accident. He mentioned the upcoming speech at the Industry Club, and Hitler replied, quote, "I think it would be better if I came myself," unquote. Thus, an announcement was sent to all the members that Herr Adolf Hitler would be the guest speaker of the Dusseldorf Industry Club. At 7 o'clock on the evening of January 27th, over 600 members of the industry club assembled in a large ballroom at the Park Hotel in Dusseldorf to hear Hitler's speech. The attendance was much larger than usual. It was the first opportunity many of the industrialists had had for getting a close view in their own familiar surroundings of a man about whom they had heard so much. These busy businessmen were not the type to run around to turbulent mass meetings. However, to attend an address organized by the club might prove to be both stimulating and interesting. The majority of those present were supporters of Gustav Stresemann's German People's Party, which was known for its pro-business attitude, or one of the other moderate, quote, bourgeois, unquote, parties. There were some with more reactionary opinions who were members of the German Nationalist Party, but with the exception of Fritz Thyssen and possibly a few others, there were no avowed National Socialists among the group. Quote, "The room was overcrowded," unquote, said Otto Dietrich in his description of the scene. Dietrich is D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H. Resuming the text, by the way, Gustav Stresemann, Gustav, of course, G-U-S-T-A-V, Stresemann, S-T-R-E-S-E-M-A-N-N. Beginning again this last paragraph, "The room," quote, "the room was overcrowded," said Otto Dietrich in his description of the scene. Again quoting, "Huddled together sat the chief West German magnates, men in the public eye and those quiet but no less influential powers who, moving behind the scenes, control the fate of the economy by the soft sounds issuing from their private offices. Men said to bear a ledger rather than a heart." Joyful expectation brightened the faces of those already converted, but the vast majority bore an air of superiority and cool reserve, probably flattered that Hitler had approached them. Mere curiosity and general interest lured them to the meeting. They wanted to hear Hitler speak. They had no intention of being converted. They came to criticize, seeking confirmation of their own infallible opinion. The audience was surprised and even a bit affronted when at Hitler's approach they heard bullying voices in the entrance hall shouting, quote, "Alles aufstehen," everybody up. Some, flabbergasted, actually rose. Others made a gesture of rising in unwilling conformity and some remained seated. Hitler strode to the rostrum amid strong silence, followed by Fritz Thyssen, the chairman of the evening, and a score of SA men in their brown shirt uniforms, who took a position behind their Führer as a sort of stage backdrop. Hitler was wearing a rather ill-fitting cutaway coat and striped trousers, an attire in which he never looked quite comfortable. After a brief introduction by Fritz Thyssen, he received, quote, chilly, unquote, applause from the tightly packed audience. He was scheduled to speak for an hour and had requested that there be no smoking. Standing on a slightly raised platform, Hitler looked out at his audience and rested his hands lightly on an ornamental railing. The audience feared communism more than anything else. Realizing this, Hitler made the danger of Marxism the central theme of his speech. He discussed the topic with rational logic and made some startlingly accurate predictions about its future development. He said it was no use dismissing communism as a mere delusion of misguided manual workers. I'm going to read this last paragraph again because it's a critical one. The audience feared communism more than anything else. Realizing this, Hitler made the danger of Marxism the central theme of his speech. He discussed the topic with rational logic and made some startlingly accurate predictions about its future development. He said it was no use dismissing communism as a mere delusion of misguided manual workers. Quote, by the way, we should bear in mind before I continue that this book is being written in 1979. Of course, communism to a large extent is a thing of the past in 1993. Bolshevism, again quoting Hitler here, "Bolshevism today is not merely a mob storming about in some of our streets in Germany, but it is a conception of the world which is in the act of subjecting to itself the entire Asiatic continent and which today, in the form of a state, Russia, stretches almost from our eastern frontier to Vladivostok," reminiscent in some ways of the evil empire speech of Ronald Reagan. Continuing with Hitler's observations, "The situation is represented as if here it was merely a question of purely theoretical problems, of views held by a few visionaries or evil-disposed individuals. No, a philosophy of life has won over to itself a state, and starting from this state, it will gradually shatter the whole world and bring it down in ruins. Bolshevism, if its advance is not interrupted, will transform the world as completely as in times past did Christianity. It is not as if this gigantic phenomenon could simply be thought away from the modern world." Unquote. Hitler argued, and this next paragraph is very important, the interpolative discussion by the Poles. Hitler argued that liberal democracy and the idea of human equality would inevitably lead to communism. Once again, Hitler argued that liberal democracy and the idea of human equality would inevitably lead to communism. Quote, "You maintain, gentlemen, that German business life must be constructed on a basis of private property. Now, such a conception as that of private property can only be defended if in some way or another it appears to have a logical foundation. This conception must deduce its ethical justification from an insight into the necessity which nature dictates." By the way, nature has a capital N here. "It cannot simply be upheld by saying, quote, it has always been so, and therefore it must continue to be so, unquote. For in periods of great upheaval, institutions and systems cannot remain untouched just because they have previously been preserved without change. It is the characteristic feature of all really great revolutionary epochs in the history of mankind that they pay astonishingly little regard for forms which are hallowed only by age. It is thus necessary to give sound foundations to traditional forms which are to be preserved so that they can be regarded as absolutely essential, as logical and right. Then I am bound to say that private property can be morally and ethically justified only if I admit that men's achievements are different. Only on that basis can I assert, since men's achievements are different, the results of those achievements are also different. And if the results of those achievements are different, then it is reasonable to leave to men the administration of those results to a corresponding degree." I'm going to read these last couple of sentences again, because they're critical. Again, we're quoting Hitler here. "Then I am bound to say that private property can be morally and ethically justified only if I admit that men's achievements are different. Only on that basis can I assert, since men's achievements are different, the results of those achievements are also different. And if the results of those achievements are different, then it is reasonable to leave to men the administration of those results to a corresponding degree. It would not be logical to entrust the administration of the result of an achievement which was bound up with a personality either to the next best but less capable person or to a community which, through the mere fact that it had not performed the achievement, has proved that it is not capable of administering the result of that achievement." Last couple of sentences again, or this last sentence again. "It would not be logical to entrust the administration of the result of an achievement which was bound up with a personality either to the next best but less capable person or to a community which, through the mere fact that it had not performed the achievement, has proved that it is not capable of administering the result of that achievement." Continuing with Hitler's speech, "Thus, it must be admitted that in the economic sphere, men are not of equal value or of equal importance. And once this is admitted, it is madness to say, in the economic sphere, there are undoubtedly differences in value, but that is not true in the political sphere. It is absurd to build up economic life on the conceptions of achievement, of the value of personality, and therefore, in practice, on the authority of personality, but in the political sphere to deny the authority of personality and to thrust into its place the law of the greater number, democracy." Once again, last couple of sentences. "And once this is admitted, it is madness to say in the economic sphere there are undoubtedly differences in value, but that is not true in the political sphere. It is absurd to build up economic life on the conceptions of achievement, of the value of personality, and therefore in practice on the authority of personality, but in the political sphere to deny the authority of personality and to thrust into its place the law of the greater number, democracy." Unquote. Then the Poles go on to say, "This statement illustrates one of Hitler's most effective arguments. It relates directly to the personal interest of the audience. By a strong logical development based on fallacious premises, Hitler was leading to the inescapable conclusion that the concept of private property would gradually be destroyed by democracy because democracy has as its ethical justification, its inner logic, the idea of human equality. If democracy continued to develop, it would gradually submerge the idea of private property, which was founded on a very different moral and ethical basis, the idea of individual differences and rewards allotted to talent. interrupting here, the pool's ruminations. These arguments are terrifyingly close to many arguments one will hear on the political right in the United States today.